Yeah, it wouldn't go. Okay.
Right, we'd be canceled. Well, suppose you went, you bought a beach lot, right, and you paid for it. Now, the price of that lot is going to reflect the fact that the previous owner knows you're going to build a house, you're near the beach, it has value. So let's suppose you pay $100,000 as an example for the lot. Now suppose you pass a law that says that because of we don't want too many more houses along the beachfront because it's damaging for pollution purposes, something like that, and therefore we're not going to allow any new construction to go up on the beach. You've just been taxed. I mean, your lot is now, you can't sell that lot to anybody for anything like what you bought it for, right? The most they're going to be able to do is pitch a tent on it. So you have really been taxed. That's a property right, and that property right has been taken away from you. Now, that doesn't mean that the government shouldn't have the right to say we're not going to allow any new lots there. What it says is that that should be just the same as if they wanted to take your lot and use it to build an electric generating station. They should buy it from you or pay you compensation, and if they don't do that, then they've taken your property without any, I mean, just simply reduced its value without giving you any compensation. Right? So that would be a property right. And that's one example of how the pollution laws many, many times are used to really take away people's private property. And an issue in the future years will be whether that's consistent under the Constitution with something called the Takings Clause of the Constitution, whether people have the right to, whether the government has the right to do that, or whether it must come in and take the property under eminent domain and pay for it. Right? And that would, I think, would be an improvement from my view. Now, that's far removed from the problems in Russia, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, where the state owned most everything, and where they have been looking for ways, trying to come up with imaginative schemes about how the state gets rid of them. It's the first time in history we've ever had anything quite like this, where in a well-developed, or at least a developed economy with lots of machinery and capital sitting around, we have to distribute it. Before, the only example we ever had is when the state took it away, right, bought it up, or socialized it. Now we're going the other way. So people have to come up with schemes for unloading that property. But they also have to develop systems of laws which define the rules under which what you can do with a property, what is your right in that property, and what is society's rights in that property. That's what happens in the community. Those rights become very important. Those are what help to determine whether society is going to progress rapidly or whether it's going to be stagnant, because they determine the kinds of incentives that people are going to have, what very much determined by what they're able to do with the property that they own. A second reason, which is related to the first, is that when we talk about human rights, one of the greatest rights that people have is the right to their property. That is, that's what protects you, right? Which says, you know, if I don't like the way my boss or somebody else behaves, I can take my money, my wealth, my intelligence, and go out and do something on my own, right? And I can do it, and it's mine, and therefore I can run my life according. That's one of the great freedoms that we have. And people who have been persecuted, have had their property, one of the first things that happens is their property is confiscated, right? That reduces their opportunity set. There are those people who believe that, for example, that one of the reasons that we find so many Jews in the academic professions is because Jews learned that the one type of property that couldn't be taken away was property which you put into your head, so that they developed early on this idea, this very strong religious belief in the importance of teaching and learning and so on, that you find in Jews, Chinese, and other people who have had many times to flee from tyrants who wanted to confiscate their property. Instead of developing property in land and buildings, they developed property in what economists now call human capital, that is, in ideas.
This is
now,
the first time.
No one knows that that's true, but it certainly is a conjecture which people have made about why it is that you find that in certain groups there is so much emphasis on learning and education and knowledge, the development of knowledge. And like the Chinese, the Jews, scholar was always somebody important. I remember my grandfather who never my maternal grandfather never worked practically a day in his life, but he was always revered by everybody because he was sitting there working on his book. I suppose there's a little bit of him in me.
You are certainly redefining the word property for me.
Well, the property...
I had no idea that it had... I assumed the property meant tangible.
Yeah.
And you're talking... You're redefining
tangible
it with...
tangible property, right. But yeah, very valuable.
But intangible, right. I didn't know.
And both of those are very important. I mean, we are a wealthy society as much because of the intangible property we have as the tangible property.
Mm-hmm.
And recent studies of what causes growth in various countries certainly bring out the role of what economists call human capital, which is this education, specialized knowledge, all that. You know.
So what? How does Webster define property? And I'll have to look it up.
Well, I don't know, but
interesting.
I can tell you how economists define property.
It very much includes
the knowledge and the skills that people acquire. And of course, if you start thinking in that way, you see quickly that, you know, if you want to see why is that building going to be torn down in an efficient way. I mean, it's because the people who are doing that, who are running those things, are very skilled and knowledgeable about doing it. I would hate to think what would happen if we just put a bunch of amateurs out there to tear down the building. I mean, we would have a mess, and of course we'd have people injured. And
it's called war.
Yes, right, exactly. Whereas these people take down the building, and they'll be followed by the people who will put up the building, and they will do equally wondrous things for those of us who are unskilled. I'm always impressed when I meet people and talk to them about what they do, how much detail there is to almost any activity that in a civilized society would perform, and just how much specialized knowledge there is that people have to have in order to run the simplest, what seem on the surface, the simplest type of operation, like running a dry cleaning store. You have to know which kinds of materials ring, which kinds spot, which kinds do damage, you know, and hosts of things of that kind that I don't really get.
And if it's well run, naturally, it looks easier,
too. It looks easy, right. I mean, it all runs very effectively, right? And, of course, the competitive system weeds out those who do a bad job. Not perfectly, but it weeds them out, and replaces them with people who do a more satisfactory job.
Calvi, do you have any questions?
Yeah. The taking clause of the Constitution, has that been brought to the Supreme Court?
Yes. The case that I gave you, actually, I mean, there are many of them coming along, and the case that I gave you was actually an example of the South Carolina case, which has gone to the Supreme Court, and there are a whole bunch of them about people using their property, and the pollution laws have brought a great many of those up. I mean, you have a field next to your house, and it's been a swamp for a while, now it's suddenly a wetland.
But decisions been made.
I think there are a few. I'm not a lawyer, so I haven't followed the exact thing. But I think but there will be. There have been, and I'm sure there will be more. The Supreme Court usually moves with a foot slowly in a direction and begins to build on it rather than making it grandiose. So I don't know what the decisions have been in some of these cases, but I know that those are going to be issues for the future.
Talking about right of domain, when you gave one example of the beach, that beach actually is, can beach property, I mean the property where the house is, but the waterfront part, and I don't know how far...
Going down to the water's edge.
Water, so
I
what...
I think, or to the high tide mark.
The high tide,
I think
okay.
It's the high tide mark. I'm not a lawyer.
No, okay, I'm
just
curious.
It's the high tide mark.
Okay.
I think you can own down to the high tide mark, and after that, of course, it's the ocean. It's a common property. Now, think about it. Here's another example of a property right, one that's very old and economic. We have fish. Now, if everybody fishes in the common ocean, who owns the fish in the ocean? Those who catch them, right? But we want the system to work so that they don't catch so many that they destroy the breeding stock, right?
Right.
That's what we want to do. So
ideally.
Yes. So that's a case where the property rights, the fish is swimming all through the common ocean, the property rights are very badly defined, and why we have these problems of conflicts which come along. For example, Russian trawlers can come off the coast and they can scoop up all the fish and package them up, but if they do too much of that, then next year when they come, or when we come, there are not going to be any fish in the ocean. And so that's a common property rights problem, and we need to find rules or things to replace the market. You see, if this were cattle, no problem. People own their cattle, they have them on their land, they can identify, brand their cattle, they know which of their cattle. They can't do that with fish. So the market system needs some supplementing in the case of fish that it doesn't have in the case of cattle. On the other hand, when we used to have open prairies, there were always, I mean, the great history of the United States is it contains this constant war between the people who wanted to raise cattle and the people who wanted a farm. We can't run much of a farm unless you have a property right. That is, you can put a fence around it and say, this is my farm, you can't drive your cattle across it. And there's an interesting example in Spanish history. One of the reasons that historians, economic historians, think that Spain, which was a wealthy country, didn't develop as rapidly as England did, was because they didn't have enclosure laws, and they allowed, actually, animals to go through fields and had a right, they had a right of way. And of course, that discouraged the formation of agriculture and farming, which, of course, provided food for the population, gave them the nutrients, made them stronger, able to work longer and more productively. And so England, which had the enclosure movement, established property rights. Those property rights were very important in making England, helping England to develop, whereas France and Spain, England and Holland, whereas France and Spain didn't do that, and consequently developed much, much later, largely because they didn't establish good rules for property ownership.
Now, aside from the things that you said that you are planning and hoping to do, is there anything like unfinished business that you have that you would, that you think about or dream about on a personal level or professionally, or that you would like to talk about? Or
not a lot. I mean, I have tried to describe for you how I've the areas that I've worked in primarily, and how I've tried to close them off as best I can, we'll go on. I don't think that as long as I am healthy and able to work, I don't think I'll retire. I'll continue to work because I enjoy what I do. So that as far as if I were, for example, if I were to retire, what would I do? I have to ask myself, what would I do differently than what I do now? Well, there would be a few things, but they're mostly small things. I would still want to read and write. So I might just as well stay here and do it at this desk as do it at another desk.
Good.
So my life is, I think, pretty much I've found a pattern of activities that please me. And as I get older, I look forward to continuing to do those, spending more time perhaps with my children, grandchildren, things that normally one wants to do. I've traveled so much in my life. Many people say, well, when I retire, I'm going to travel. Probably when I retire, I'll stop traveling. I've done so much of that in my life.
Gabby?
As I see you for points, I think they're sort of equally divided between U.S. and world.
Yeah.
Am I? Is that a good assumption?
Yeah.
I have to phrase this so it doesn't sound too naive. But can you apply U.S. constitutional law, or the way the U.S. government is structured, to world economy and the kind of world that you hope to see?
Well, yes and no. I mean, every country has its own culture, tradition,
yeah,
history that shapes it, and so to that extent there are differences between countries. But some things, I believe, are common, and I think we see evidence of that. I had a long evening discussion with the former German chancellor where we divided on that issue of whether how much similarity is there in Chancellor Schmidt, with how much similarity and difference there are. So I believe that, that people everywhere want respect as individuals, want a legal framework which gives them equality before the law, things of that kind. And that's common to people. The particular implementation will be different in every country. We have a one kind of government. Some other country will have a parliamentary government, so the laws and the ways in which they'll operate, and, they'll be different. And even in countries like Germany, where after World War II, we imposed on the Germans a lot of American institutions, we shaped their institutions, and even more so in Japan, we reshaped their institutions. And like
most people, when we thought about, well, now what's a good way to do things, we thought about, well, how do we do it? And so we put those institutions. But when we look back after 40 or 50 years, we see that they're not the same as our institutions, that they've developed along their own path. But when we also see that as we brought competition, the breakup of monopolies, the opening up of rights for individuals in Japan, a parliamentary democracy, doesn't function like ours, but it functions, that they're doing things pretty much, broadly speaking, like us. They save, they invest, they grow, they become wealthy over that period. So our general way of doing has worked very well for them and has been a model that others have now adopted. One of the great transformations which occurred, I believe, as important as any other single thing, was the image that people had, for example, in China, that when they looked around and saw that here were North and South Korea, two countries, actually the South was destroyed by the war, and it was a poor part of the country to begin with. Yet when you look back after 40 years, the people in North Korea have a per capita income of perhaps $900. The people in South Korea have a per capita income of something like $7,000 to $8,000. Well, those lessons, I mean, the same thing is true if you look at Hong Kong and mainland China. People swam across the river to get from mainland China to Hong Kong. At the time, they probably had an income of $200 a year. $200 a year. 40 years later, they had an income of $10,000 per capita, whereas the people they left behind were still struggling at $400 or $500 a year. Well, those lessons, more than any theory, must have been very impressive for people who were looking around about what works in economic development. I expect that when the Chinese leadership looked at that, they saw that they had been reading from the wrong book, that what had worked for all the countries around them that had adopted some form of the market system had gotten rich. Japan, South Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, Thailand, and here they were still struggling. Well, that had a very profound effect. And I think it forced them to rethink where they were and what they were doing, and thereby adopt some form of capitalism and eventually democratic capitalism, because capitalism doesn't work unless there is sufficient freedom for individuals to do with their persons and property, very much their property, what they think is in their best interest. So, of course, they keep pushing out against the boundaries, here, there, everywhere. They push against the boundaries. Why do we have to have this law? Why do we have to have this restriction? Why can't we do this? Other people do that. It doesn't work badly. Why can't we do more? And so that's pushing out the boundaries of individual rights. Now, at the same time, of course, we have all these claims for redistribution. The health care bill, which we're talking about now, is just another in a long line of examples. I mean, government can't produce health care. The government can't provide health care. All it can do is change who pays for the health care. Health care has to be provided by doctors, hospitals, medical equipment, and so on. But usually those things are organized best in the private sector, that is, by individuals striving to perform a good service. Now the government wants to come in and redistribute the cost of health care, but that's redistribution. So we have these two tendencies in society, the one which is the striving for growth through individual effort, the other one is to redistribute the proceeds up and down the income scale. Both of those processes are work. That's what democratic capitalism is. It's harnessing the work of those people who lead, who provide, who use their property and their abilities to produce more, and then a political system which redistributes those according to notions of equity and fairness. But redistribution is just another equity and fairness are just another nice name for redistributing the proceeds. And that's a system that we have. And that system appeals to people because it doesn't mean that those who do the most can gain much, much faster than everyone else. It means that they can gain faster, but that we tax away a lot of what they do in order to redistribute it. And that's what makes the system continue to work. Different people have different views about how much of that should be done and how much that should. We have no mechanism for solving that decision, making that decision, other than through the democratic process with all of its flaws and inefficiencies. arbitrary decision. Nevertheless, that's the only process that man has come up with that people accept as being reasonable, or fit, or what they call fair. The person has one vote. So that's the system that we have, and that system we see spreading in different ways throughout most of the world. Now, the next step will be, I think, a question about why do we need, in a world, if the world stays at peace, why do we need big centralized governments in far distant places? What problems should be left to us at our local level? Why do we need a law which says everybody has the same educational rules? Why can't we experiment in our own region? Why should we have, why should there be rules, for example, about a very contentious issue like abortion? Why can't we make them local so those people who want it can have it, and those people who want, don't want it, they can have what they want? Why should we have one law for the whole country? You see, in fact, we moved from the position originally which said we're going to have one law for the whole country to moving much back to each state is going to have its own law. We saw the same process go on years ago with pornography. You have Supreme Court justices deciding what was pornographic. They could never decide that. I mean, it was the kind of thing where, as they say, you know it when you see it. But why do you need to have all that the same for everybody who lives in Missoula, Montana, New York City? Why not have separate rules? They have their rules, you have your rules. If you don't like it, you can go somewhere where the rules are more to your liking. So I think many issues are going to be of that kind. As if we live in a world of peace, if we're fortunate, we're going to see much more pressure for people to want to have a greater say about the rules under which they live. And that's going to require them to have more decentralization. So I think that's going to happen. And as trade expands, as the economies expand, trade expands, we break down the rules for trade, then some of the cement which binds people together in nation states weakens. For example, the people in Quebec, they can do their business here. They don't need the rest of English Canada. So they can have French-speaking Canada with trade in English-speaking the United States. They don't need to have the bond. That doesn't mean they necessarily want to leave Canada. But they can weaken those bonds with the federal Canadian government, and I think over time they will. The same thing is going to happen in many other countries where you have big agglomerations which represent the nation-state of the 17th, 18th century. Those will begin to weaken if we live in a world at peace. War, power flows to the centralized government. It requires big centralized governments to marshal the resources for military operations. So those operations will perhaps stay centralized. Anyway, that's part of this issue about thinking about the politics and foreign policy of the future and how it will come out. And I'm just beginning to speculate on something.
This is a very hypothetical question.
Yes, well, so is what I've been doing.
Right. Okay. What happens to the economy without war?
Oh, it's fine. It's fine.
Is it really?
Oh, yes. I mean, we don't need wars. We don't need wars. I mean, wars are destructive. I mean, you know, in war you build a lot of things that you hopefully don't use. But you don't have them, so you put people to work making things that you're not going to buy. That's which are not going to be around for people to use. I mean, we're going to be much better off if we can live in a world which is both secure and peaceful. We're a long way from doing that. But live in a world that's secure and peaceful, we're going to have much more that's going to raise our standard of living.
Okay, certainly Russia is a perfect example of that, hopefully. When you discuss the economy, it is all very, very logical to me, but it's very pure. Then the politician comes and uses all these issues.
Yes.
And what happens then? There's a distortion, isn't there?
We get these distortions, that's right. We get the distortions which come in a democratic society. But, you know, but other people, you see, well, that's a great advantage of decentralizing. Other people are doing things differently. So some neighborhoods, countries, they're going to say, well, let's do this way. Somebody else got to do it that way. And after a while, just as, you know, and these are spans of years, if not days, but years, we look around and we see that we're doing things well. They're not doing so well. So let's not copy what they're doing. And they begin to say, well, maybe if we move a little bit in the direction of what they're doing, we'll be better off too. That's what's happened in so many developing countries. You know, the first 10, 15 years, we had two groups of countries, the Asian countries and the Latin American countries. If you looked at them at the end of the first 10 years after World War II, or even the first 15 years after World War II, you would have thought that they were both growing about the same, raising incomes and standards of living. But they pursued very different strategies. The Asian countries mostly relied on trade and open economies, and the Latin Americans mostly relied on what they called import substitution. They closed economies with high tariffs and didn't trade. Now, at the end of 15 years, they looked about the same. But at the end of 30 years, they looked vastly different, vastly different. Now, what's happened? Well, the Latin American countries have seen what happened in the Asian countries, and they are now beginning to open up, modernize, and so on. So you have these wonderful examples of Mexico,
NAFTA.
Argentina, right, joining NAFTA, joining the Europe, you know, becoming a middle-sized developing country. And just as one should suspect, you see, as this pressure, as it gets to be more of a middle class, as it needs, as it develops a telecommunication system, there's more competition in society, people begin to demand political rights. So you see the democratic system opening up and Mexico moving much more away from one party rule and sort of the hegemony of a single oligarchy into a much more democratic market economy.
So that, you're saying in
I
the way...
That's what people want.
So what I'm hearing is that then there is the radical movements don't have the clout because there is more of a middle class and they are prospering, so they don't need to need the help from someone who says, we're going to save you from this, and they're going to say, so the influence of these radicals is going to become less, is that?
Has become less, certainly in Mexico, in Argentina,
okay.
And I think in Europe, I mean, after all, the Communist Party has disappeared in Europe. They changed their name. They don't even call themselves.
But there's a resurge now for Stalinism. I mean,
No. But you see, that's misleading. I mean,
okay.
These people have come back, the people who were there, but they no longer are selling the same goods. The Poles, for example, have gone back and they've elected what people who were officials of the Communist Party. But what are they doing? They're privatizing. They're continuing this market expansion. Now, they may shade the line somewhat on how much redistribution there is, how much we trade off growth today or redistribution today, but they certainly, none of them, talk about going back to a Stalinist type of economy. And there's not much support for that. Even in East Germany, you asked me about East Germany. Well, the biggest number that you hear about former communists coming back into power, and we don't even know what they would do if they came back into power, whether they would still become, is perhaps 20% of East Germany. Right? And that probably covers heavily the people who lost their jobs running the state enterprises and their families. There isn't a big groundswell. There's a big ferment about what should be the next step, but how they should move. But there is not a big groundswell to return to communism in any of these countries. That is to return to the Russian style of rule, because most people, I believe, there, here, everywhere, have concluded it didn't work. That they really went backwards. Didn't grow. Africa is an example of socialism gone amok. So it's one of the dark spots on the economic development scheme. I mean, there are very few countries that you can point to in Africa, particularly in Africa south of the Sahara, that has developed at all over the last 10, 15, or 20 years. So that people are impoverished and staying in. Now, that isn't to say we're going to live in the world in a perfect world. We're not. Of course, we're people. We have all sorts of social problems, as we know, crime, delinquency, all those things, which are drugs, which are serious problems for society.
You mentioned that you spent some time with Helmut Schmidt. Is there anything you'd like to tell us about?
No, I just told you probably the
kind of an impression he made.
Well, he's a very... a strong-minded man with very very strong views about almost any issue that I've heard him talk about. He's clearly a very bright and able man. As I say, he has very strong views, not quite the same as mine.
And I'd like to just comment on one more thing, and then Robbie, it's your turn. World federalism. Is there any hope?
I don't think there's going to be. I think that we're going to move in two different directions. There are problems which need to be solved at the world level. Water, ocean pollution would be one of those. So we need some. So the national governments cannot individually do that. So we need some way of solving the problem. But none of us are willing to have our taxes, spending, welfare decisions move to the United Nations. I mean, heaven forbid, that would be the last thing I think that most of us would want. I think the two things are going to happen at the same time, but there are issues where we need broader organizations. Trade is clearly one of them, and we're now in the process of it.